Good afternoon, everyone. Ooh. Which one do I speak to? Nice to have you all here. I'm looking forward to today's colloquium presentation. It's a duo, Lori Lehman and Judy Mullett, who happen to be related, but I think that's probably irrelevant to the research. We might hear more about that. But they did a creative sabbatical proposal last year to work on a project together during their sabbatical, and we're going to be hearing about that today. Lori Lehman is an associate professor in the education department. Her areas of expertise are in learning theory and learning outcomes and assessment. Judy Mullett is professor in the psychology department, but she also has training in education with a master's in school psychology and a doctorate in special ed. I'm intrigued by the title. I want to find out how truth lies. So, welcome.
So we'll talk about the picture first. The image that we pulled up here is purposeful. There are two chairs. They're plural. And our sabbatical turned into be a journey of trying to discover truth and doing it together. And what we found is that in getting out of our offices, our normal spaces, that as we sat side by side and shared this space, that lots of things happened literally in between that space. And we often were looking at the same thing, so at the water's edge. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that today. We aren't in those chairs anymore, and sometimes we wish we were. But we invite you to sit with us today in those chairs, and we're going to invite you to think about your teaching or other interactional experiences that you have with others. It may be in working at building peace, it may be in counseling, it may be in a personal relationship. So whatever image you would like to use, but thinking about your plural journeys together.
Here's another image and a story. This is a photograph taken on Sunday. And these are two Jims or James, versions of the same name. On the right is my husband, Jim, and on the left is our grandson, James. Now, Sunday was the first time that they sort of revealed their little ritual. It's the very first ritual. He's 7 months old. And the way that it works is that Jim leans in and puts his head down, and then James will lean in, sort of flutter his eyes until their heads impact, till they meet, they butt heads. And that's a wonderful thing in and of itself. That's their first ritual. And again, it's the impact. It's sort of the two people coming together, the truth here and the plural. They're looking for that impact. But the joy of it was suddenly on Sunday that James just leaned over against on his shoulder and put his head down. And thereafter, when he wanted to initiate it, he would put his head down and move towards Jim. So it became this sort of dance, this sort of ritual, either one, sort of a sharing power. So this particular headbutting, when we look at what happened at those chairs, there's a kind of headbutting that happened, but the best kind. And I think framing it in this kind of headbutting makes all the difference in the world. How you frame your teaching makes all the difference. So we did some headbutting, the good kinds and some of the hard kind, but out of that came what we're calling restorative teaching and a model that we've been playing with and working with and would like to share part of that with you today.
So we took a generational sabbatical. I am Lori Ann Hostetler Lehman, and this is Judy Hostetler or Hostetler Mullett.
And let me tell you, starting with another story about recycling for light. How did we get here? How did we get to this point where we decided to work together? Well, her father happens to be my brother, and he's also a noted author, a co-author. He has 90-some math textbooks out there. And he retired, oh, it's been a little while now, and he moved to this particular area. And one of the things he chose to do fairly recently is to work at volunteer at Booksavers. And his favorite thing to do is to use the machine that cuts off the back of books so that the binding of them, so that the pages are freed, and they can be recycled. And so one day, his stack had one of his books in there that he was cutting off and he was recycling. And he looked at it as freeing those pages for somebody else to write on, to start again. Well, you know, I'm a senior faculty here now. And I love to think and talk and talk and talk. But, you know, I have lots of books up here, but lots of empty pages. And so when it came time for sabbatical and I started asking people, what should I do? And they said, write, Judy, write. And I've been working in restorative discipline particularly for quite a while now. And I've been fascinating with what's missing there. And that's the moment-to-moment restorative promise that can happen. So I thought, oh, I wanted to write about that. But I will think forever and not write. And so I looked around. And Lori was having a sabbatical at the same time. And who better to share that? Because she was a friend, she shares my passion for teaching. She's a person who just gets things done. If you know Lori, she can get lots of done in short order. So I know she would give direction. I knew she would challenge me in the right way. I knew she knew my weaknesses. And again, we shared our love and our passion for teaching. So we began as a we. We butted heads as a we. And she did so much more of the writing than what I did. And she's now a sister in ways that I couldn't even have imagined. And I suspect we'll sit in the chairs by the lake for a long, long time.
So my generational sabbatical began 9 years ago when I arrived at EMU. And when I got here, my professors were here teaching. And so Don Steiner was here, J.B. Landis was here, and Judy Mullett was here. And watching them teach was very inspirational, but it's hard to translate by watching. And talking about teaching, that was actually very helpful. I had mentoring already in my first year, and one of the hardest things that I faced was a moment of conflict with my first special ed methods classes, and it was real conflict. We actually kind of did a circle process because the students were upset with me. So talking was good. But there was a part of me that yearned for talking about teaching as something different, and not just talking about it, but understanding it together. And so for me, the sabbatical was an invitation to kind of be in those chairs and talk about the teaching, because I've struggled to try to teach others about teaching. About what's really deep in my soul is the fact that teaching is bigger than theory, and teaching is bigger than strategies. But for me, learning takes place, and teaching is about the we part. And so as I looked around, it was an opportunity for me to ask again for help on this new journey. And one of my interests has to do with working in schools as a teacher in areas especially of conflict. And my last teaching experiences in Pittsburgh were high area of conflict. Most of the students in my school had criminal records. So on a daily basis, and trying to make sense of that. And the challenge then became, as I thought about this, how much I could gain, because I don't have a lot of the theoretical background in the wording, but how much I could gain from working with Judy, my aunt, who's always taught me to look at things from a different perspective. I just found a drawing that I made of my grandfather's shoe, and it's beautiful shading. And she taught me to turn the shoe upside down and look at it upside down and try to draw from a different perspective. And so my hope in this was to work together. The challenge is this. I've seen her teach her classes on restorative discipline. How do you put Judy in a book? So we also discovered in our research that there are generations of we in peace building in schools. So I'm going to just read a little bit from one of our parts of the book. we find generations of our teacher ancestors who were tasked with the job of creating peace in schools. In the more distant past, when the center of the American school was based in a more agrarian farming community, the values of character and resolving conflict were taught at home, and then the message of peace was restated in schools. Be kind, share, don't hit. The first generation taught the message of living peacefully. In our more recent past, however, as students have found themselves living amongst peers who are vastly different from themselves, and as life has become more competitive in the 21st century, we realize the need to teach students the processes and skills for resolving instances of conflict to learn how to demonstrate respect. Yet something's still missing. Students know it and we know it. The message, the knowledge of skills and processes do not a life make. We have become the third generation with different needs. It's become all too apparent that we need to live and embody peace, not as an isolated skill for a time-bound incident of conflict in our schools, but as a way of living as real people all day long in school and in our neighborhoods.
Now, Lori and I come across generations, and in some sense across disciplines, because of where I'm at and where she is at this particular point in time. So today, we're going to focus on these next aspects, this plurality of gaps in our best. So one of the first things we got together is what's missing. Because I had envisioned earlier on thinking if I want to do just writing alone, that it would be a how-to book, how to do that moment-to-moment restorative practices, but then we started looking, okay, what are the gaps that are there? I saw a gap in the moment-to-moment. I saw the relational gap, too. But when we got together, we came to understand, and through our writing and our reading, that there are other gaps. And so we started with those gaps, and we're going to talk more about when those are specifically. And then we also looked at what are we really doing well. What is the best that's out there? I mean, sometimes I get the question, and quite often you get the, so restored to what? What do you mean restorative discipline? Restored to what? And in the quickest response to capture probably the most what we're talking about is restored to bringing your best person to the table. And that means that there is that best within all of us, right? And when we're in conflict or if we've been harmed, so often the worst comes out. Right, and there's this gap between what you're showing here and what could be. So we looked at gaps and we looked at the best.
We also very quickly found that we have a plurality of our theories in all of our disciplines, yet they're all around a common goal, which is a huge goal. It's called peace on earth. And from my educational standpoint, bringing in strategies, et cetera, I wanted more of what's the psychology behind it? What's in the relationship? And Judy, perhaps as teaching restorative discipline as processes, was saying the same thing. Well, how do people actually learn this and make it their own from a psychology standpoint, from attachment theory? And so we decided not one theory has any claim on the truth, and that it is through our lenses that these theories come together, because what we're talking about when we talk about conflict and we talk about restoring ourselves, it's really about living. And so we're pretty convinced that we needed to take the best from all of those and synthesize them. Change doesn't happen, though, just with information read in our book, and it would require insight, inspiration, and imagination. And I gathered lots and lots of books and put them on a shelf and scanned and skimmed and read. And Judy would grab onto one of the ideas and imagine and be inspired, and the space between the chairs seemed to work pretty well.
So through our conversations, through looking at gaps, through looking at our best and looking at the theory that's out there, we came up with sort of the impact, the heads butting. Together with restorative teaching, and perhaps it might be framed best this way. I love the story of the young child, and she's in Sunday school, and then the teacher says, "Okay, what's gray, likes to live outside and run up trees and eat nuts?" And she says, "I'd like to say a squirrel, but my answer is Jesus." And that's the little bit what's happened, I think, in our education in schools. You ask teachers and they say, yeah, I know, I want to teach the whole child. I know that we're really growing people. I want to focus on that. But, you know, the answer is the standards of learning. Right? The answer is these particular outcomes. So our restorative teaching model, it was meant to design, to develop mindsets, modes, and movements is what we were calling them, to sort of develop these attitudes and these ways of being with children.
So if we talk about plurality, that can take us in many directions and many definitions, but we invite you to frame the idea of plurality as the we effect today. That's how we are going to use the term throughout the rest of our presentation. And this quote exemplifies what we are thinking about when we talk about plurality. The we effect lies in our relationship. It takes two. The growth happens in the interaction. It's not just here or here. Meaning happens within the space between people. And perhaps even meaning happens in the space between ideas. So, two sabbatical chairs at the water's edge, we had the same context, we were reading the same things, but meaning was shaped in the space between those two things. We also can think about truth, and we won't go there in defining it in many other ways today, but we'd like you to think about the way we termed truth, and we didn't stumble upon this right away. But at one point we were sitting there and we were talking about something, looking at our notes, and all of a sudden one of us stopped and said, you know, in this book, we're actually telling the Bible story that God's love. Can we do that in a book? And we actually haven't used those words throughout the book, but it's the fingerprint is all over it. Because in the end, truth for us in this book means living more fully into God's intent for me as a teacher, as a student, which means loving God, my brothers and sisters, more fully. Truth is to love more fully.
So as we began to look at gaps and to give us some direction of what's missing there and then looking at our best selves, I was reminded that I'm a person, and I don't know if you're like that or not, but I tend to study things I'm not good at. Like I studied conflict and restorative justice because I'm not real good at it. And I remember a principal walking in my office one time and said, uh-oh, you're not going to like what I have to say. But I just read that so many people pick up in college what challenged them in high school, and it wasn't necessarily because they were really, really good at it, it's because it was harder for them, and so it challenged them more, so they're sort of picking up what their gift might not have been, so they went with the gap and not the gifts here. So, but you need to do both. You need to also, I mean, look at the gaps and as well as the best, so we're going to talk a little bit about what we discovered. And Xander and Xander put it really, really well. What am I being that others are not shining? And that's the idea of looking at the gaps. Where are we not shining? And so we looked at the literature. We looked at what's out there. We discovered what we saw as a relational gap that teachers are sort of calling for, this life skills, this idea of, and Shelley Taylor did that really well in the tending instinct, said there's something within us that want to learn how to tend and befriend and mend. And so we saw that gap. We're not seeing that in teaching practices and theory quite like we would like to. Now, so many writers write bits and pieces of that, but I think we have a model that maybe just gives a little bit of a different flavor, maybe not as unique as we might think it is at times, but it's slightly different. A conflict gap, this opportunity in conflict, that comes from the conflict resolution and conflict transformation literature, is that in every conflict, there's the opportunity to grow, either become bitter or better, and so that's a gap that we saw. A theoretical gap, teaching as a lifestyle, in and out the classroom, throughout. You carry it with you wherever you go. We didn't see that. Being in relationship, that moment-to-moment aspect. And then the learning gap. And this focused so much on the achievement component of learning needs, the need to make a difference in the world. But it's also a need to belong and to balance those and to use those in tandem. And then the teaching gap. Pedagogical well-being. There's a lot in the literature out there right now about teachers, sort of that inner desire to teach more fully and not just to a particular content or a particular way. As one teacher said it really well in Poplin and Weave's work, no one ever taught me how to have a serious conversation with children. It's not that I don't want to, I don't know how to. I'm afraid. So those are some of the gaps we identified. And then we looked, okay, so what are we doing well? What is the strength that we want to capture and work with? And first of all, we looked at teaching as a lifestyle, as a way of being in the world, a way of having integrity, a way of doing this continuously in what we do. And then we looked at priming. The honorable self through mindset modes and moves. And priming is really particular. Whatever you went on before you walked into a classroom, it primes you to act a certain way, to see certain things, to do certain. So we attend into the priming literature, and there's so much out there in social psychology. Some of that's come under attack recently because there are so many depends variables as are a part of that. But there are so many. I mean, I had to think when we were introduced and stood in the middle here, what that does to you, it brings something different to a person because they're simply standing in between those. So those are the elements that we identified and began to work with.
So we looked at a lot of theories, and it's hard to summarize all of these here, so we've selected a few. The proposed intent of our sabbatical was to write a little to medium book. Judy and Lorraine Stutzman Amstutz have written the little book series on restorative discipline. And so we wanted to write one about addressing the minute-to-minute mindful interactions of teachers with students, particularly in discipline situations. But through all of this research, we kept saying, well, the thing that we function under isn't here. It's here, but it's not quite named. So our goal then turned into figuring out how to synthesize this because it seems to be a little more distinctive. And if it's not that common, we need to write it down before we can write a little book because otherwise the book doesn't make any sense. So we're trying to move from just what are the strategies and the processes to the impact of the person, the teacher, or the two individuals, or the trainer, or whomever it is. And how do you make it work? So we decided we couldn't write that little book, and we are trying to develop a theory of practice for a term that we intend to publish called restorative teaching. This has led us to kind of summarize this view of conflict. We seem to get hung up on designing methods to eradicate conflict in schools, get rid of it, while ironically we're preparing kids for a world in which conflict exists all around us and them all the time. Perhaps then it's time to normalize conflict in what we call the normal daily landscape of conflict. It's known as relationship. Michelle LeBaron says conflict is a relationship on a bumpy road. At the center of all the curricula, the conflict resolution processes, the strategies that we use in schools is actually the relationship of the student with himself, his ideals, his peers, his teachers, and the larger world, all entities that at some point he experiences conflict with. So we're back to that plurality of theories and trying to find that common thread. And we've decided that terminology is one of the biggest problems. And in fact, many persons who have written in evaluating any of these theories have said, we really need to start to use a common language. Not only do we believe we need a common language, but somewhere in the plurality of our chairs is each of us revealing some part of that truth. And we think we need that because peace on earth is a really big agenda. So teaching, learning in schools is really a hotbed for testing all of these theories, psychological, educational, conflict theory, restorative justice, because we're in the business of growing lives. So anything else that's out there is evident in schools. And one of the words that came to mind is this idea of being dismembered. These theories are all there. The truth is all there, but in some ways, if they remain in separate silos, we have dismembered the truth of how to work with conflict. And so we'd like to invite, in our book, everyone to begin pulling up those sabbatical chairs and remembering, putting back together, recalling the very best from all of our theories, because resolving conflict, bringing about peace, is really about living. So, just a little bit of a smattering of several quotes. Those in the social science fields, those outside of education with that top quote, are actually saying we need to bring in learning theory into our theories and strengthen those processes. And the reverse is perhaps beginning to happen in schools when we're talking about learning and bringing in theories from these other fields. The second quote highlights the challenge of studying peace and conflict strategies in schools, because how do you measure the results? And oftentimes we measure them by measuring things such as number of suspensions, out of school suspensions, have they been reduced? We want those things to happen. We may measure other things such as the number of conflicts that are happening. The difficult part is that the adults in the building are changing as well, and a school culture is changing. What we don't know is whether those kids have actually adopted the theories and the living it out in their own lives, or are they simply making decisions to fit in with what's happening? In other words, how do we measure whether it's making that internal change? The third quote on situated learning. This is often used in the business field and in business, talking about how do we train people more in an apprenticeship model. And this is done in a community setting where relationship with truth exists, because that master apprentice is using that space in between himself and the person that he's mentoring. And it's high judgment. You can't tell an apprentice what to actually say in a training process. You can't tell them when to say it. You can't tell them the body language, the tone, etc. But it all makes a difference. We know that in teaching, that our teachers can say the very best things, but it's about something else, and this something else is what we're trying to name. We also know on the last quote that relationships matter in learning. Studies are being done now that academic achievement goes up when certain relational relationships are developed on the part of the teacher and thinking about that very purposefully. And so we're simply saying, well, how about then when we teach about conflict in schools or about building peace? Does it matter? So it seems apparent that the common thread among all of these theories is that living is an activity that guarantees two things, conflict and learning. So if living is learning to navigate conflict, and healthy living is learning to navigate conflict in ways that are meaningful and honor our best self and the best selves of others, then any attempts to talk about building peaceable lives for our students, present and future living, must pay attention to the best that all of these theoretical fields have to offer. So, here is our working definition of restorative teaching. We've done good work in creating the structured processes for restorative justice, anti-bullying programs, conflict resolution programs. That's the overt informing task of teaching, because we're teaching processes. When we focus only on the structured processes with children and youth, we create an artificial boundary for conflict, indicating perhaps falsely that resolving conflict only happens successfully within that process. When in fact, if it truly happens successfully, growth can happen within that moment, but also in the moments prior to or following conflict, within relationship with self and others. Our hope is that this model fulfills the promise of these processes by pushing out the relational aspect so that conflict is shaped by living, the act of being restorative together, both inside the moments of conflict and outside the moments of conflict. As all good teachers know, there's more to teaching than the science of it. The art of it requires messy work, because boundaries become fuzzy and rules are bent, not to abuse, but to answer to the higher purposes of teaching, developing the whole child for lifelong living journey.
So our in coming out of our definition then, is the concept, again, of living into our best selves. And so, again, living and decision-making that happens continually and with students, among students, and amidst our enactment of curriculum. So it's, and we want to look specific. It's an embodiment of our habits. And so to do that, sort of the bulk of our work has been on those mindsets, modes, and moves, and it took a lot for us to come up with, is that the terminology that we really want? And some of those are really familiar, and they will be, but let's talk about them a little bit more. And if I give you an example, then these will make a whole lot more sense. And we won't go into detail what are the specific mindsets and the modes and the moves necessarily, but hear this example. It was just, oh goodness, about 3 weeks ago, I was coming out of a grocery store and ran into a principal that I had given a workshop at her school a long, long time ago, and she said, oh, I have to tell you this story, and thank you so much for doing that workshop. She said, just the other day, we had a student who had stolen a teacher's computer. And he was caught in the process of stealing that, so he owned up to that. So he brought the teacher in, and you're having this conversation, a restorative conversation with him and the teacher. And he started with this, the blaming sort of thing, and oh, I just really needed that, and we're poor, and he went through all that process. And she stopped in the middle, you know, after he was done saying that, and she paused for a minute, and she said, this isn't about the computer. This is about relationships, your relationship with us. We care about you. We've been hurt by this. And she said his whole demeanor, and he started crying. And the whole way that he framed it, just because she framed it in that manner, changed. And everyone around that table began to understand a little bit more about who he was. And then they could work in how do we do this, how do we make this right? So I want to look at what happened in that particular context. And this is the mindset. You come in with beliefs, right? We have beliefs. And unless you articulate those and you make those mindful before, some other belief that just comes in on the way in will influence what you do. So part of that is the mindfulness of your beliefs. For example, that conflict is an opportunity. So that you're not looking at that as, oh, that's a pain and somebody else needs to work with that. It's an opportunity for growth. And so that's one of those. It's your beliefs and your attitudes, and you prime them. So if you're mindful of those, you're more likely to recognize and take the opportunities that are there. Now, you know that. You come in with those beliefs. We have the mission statement all over the place, right? Those are our beliefs that we come in with. But the mode, this is the one that fascinates me more than any of the rest, probably because it's the manner or the approach or the stance that you take. So she came in with this with the belief that conflict is opportunity. She had a part, and that relationships are important. Right? The primacy of relationships. She came in with that was salient to her. This is even by calling it a restorative conversation. She had those values in front of her. Then she had to decide. You know, what stance do I take, or do I absorb? You know, this is like walking in front of somebody, walking with. You decide those things, and that depends. It's a depends model. It depends on what's going on in that particular classroom with that person. And she recognized, you know, she was listening. She was absorbing all that, which is really one of the modes that we're talking about. And she chose to do a mending. Okay, mending is also, she knew that there were going to be some mending here. But she named something there. She named something that it's about relationship. She framed it differently. Now, that's what we mean by modes. And you do that, sometimes we do that unconsciously. But to do that more intentionally means that you have to listen. You know, I just discovered, wow, last semester, and that was maybe one of the byproducts, if you ask what happened, I became more people-first oriented. That's some of the mindset. People first, problems second. And I noticed that I get so wrapped up in the content sometimes that I don't even look at students sometimes. Wow. And that used to be the centrality of what I did. I didn't know that I could teach if I didn't look in your eyes, if I didn't see you. But I was realizing it. Sometimes 10 minutes would go by, and I was worried about my content and doing all this and getting it just right, and I wasn't looking at the people. So that mode is, what is the stance? What is the approach you're going to take there? And then the moves is the nitty-gritty stuff. That's just the practices. You could take the same practice that's good and somebody applies it here and it doesn't work somewhere. And it has because you haven't primed your beliefs and you haven't listened carefully enough, watched, observed, to know that I had to walk ahead of, behind, or in back of in terms of your mood. And an example of that is I taught a course in Lancaster this last fall, and one of the teachers was so enamored with this concept of when she worked with really, really tough kids that would pick up chairs and throw them, and they were in a class for behavior support at that time. And so she was talking about what she usually does in those situations. Then we talked about, you know, conflict, the opportunities that are there, the mode that you take. What about restorative approach here? And so one time she just tried it. She said a kid blew up, threw the chair across the table, and, you know, it's one of those, you're going to get them out of here, and the other kid's crying because they'd been arguing. And she just said, wow, that's hard to watch. And then she just waited. And she said some kids started over here, said, yeah, I just don't like when that happens. And another one here. Pretty soon the kid had thrown, came over, and started to tell his story about what happened. Now that, she said, oh, I wouldn't always do it. And sometimes I don't do it in that manner. But that was the move. But it had to come first with her ideas about what do I believe? What stance am I going to take here? What does the situation demand? And then what choice, the nitty-gritty strategies. And most of the time when you pick up books, they're the strategies. And if you're a new teacher, that's what you want to hear. You want to hear the strategies.
So that's sort of a summary of where the theory has led us, and you'll have to read the book to get all of the details on these three parts. But we would like to invite you to look at from your chair, from whatever image that you chose at the beginning here, to think about how you can look at this a little differently. And this is something that comes from teacher education self-study research known as assumption hunting. It's hunting for those taken for granted beliefs about the world and your place within it that seem so obvious to us as not to be stated explicitly. And what we found is that when we name our assumptions about how we're dealing in a relationship, that then you have to assumption hunt at another level to try to figure out how to see it very differently. And so as you step outside of your own teaching today, and we have conflict sometimes with our students because they're not getting what we want them to get, stepping outside and saying, maybe I'm not in the right mode for them to get what they need to get. So as you think through these questions, try to assumption hunt. We want you to look at your best and your gaps. So the first question, just think about your best teaching or interactional experience. What did it look like, sound like, feel like? And you can think about what were your beliefs in that situation? What mode were you trying to put yourself in? And the hardest one to put yourself in is the one that's the most vulnerable. And as teachers, we want to step back into that control. The second question, examine a gap, a time when it didn't go so well, and go through that same journey. And then the we effect of truth about whatever you're experiencing and generations. Can you begin to sense a new awareness of truth in your teaching as you do this? And then thinking about who would you like to have a conversation with? And our conversations were very animated at times. And sometimes one of us would just turn and go back and go, we had two desks, go back to the desk and start reading some more, and there was silence. At one point, we stood at the stop sign at Mount Clinton and Smith Avenue for 2.5 hours. And you can imagine, we're both gesturing out there, and somebody went by several times and finally stopped and asked us about it. It wasn't always pretty, but what it was truthful. And it helped us, I think, form a deeper relationship that we realized in our intellect, in our scholarship, and by the way, actually what it did was catapult our scholarship that we had many other things started in and sending them out. We can't emphasize enough the we effect here at the end, and just encourage you to consider that. So I think at this point we'd like to open it up for a question and answer, discussion, dialogue, and we're very comfortable if the dialogue is even happening here, not here, so wherever the chairs are. Responses, questions.
This is probably a very rudimentary question, but whenever I think about use of the term restorative, I'm thinking in terms of restoring what? And so with restorative teaching, what are you looking for?
And I think that's always the ongoing question. And often we looked at it in terms of, oh, it's the relationship. But sometimes they didn't have a relationship before. Lorraine Sitzmanowicz always say, after they get into a conflict, well, you do now. It's not a good one, but you have a relationship. So that was her sort of standard one. But I would come back to that. There is something within you that's your best self. You know, you would say, that's my best teaching, that's the best thing that I taught, or I had the best conversation with someone, and you were your best. I mean, there's that old adage, find somebody who makes you feel like you're the best person and marry them, right? Because you want to be your best person. So for me, it's discovering that. It's bringing that out. How do you prime someone? And you prime them by taking your best, and you know, that's sort of the underlying theory here that we're pursuing, is if I bring my best, if I bring what I value, and if I am sensitive with my modes that are there, and then I choose a strategy based on what that is, then I will bring out the best in you, because I've given my best. It becomes that best and best. You know, we're here to make each other better people. I mean, again, the Xander and Xander thing, who am I being that others are not shining? How do we do that? So I always say, to restore to your best self. And if you look at that in a conflict situation or an abuse situation where somebody hurts another person and they are purely to respond, they're both end up hurting. They, you know, the questioning that goes on in the person who is harmed, and many times from the person who did the harm, the questions about themselves or the questions of blaming somebody else, they're not their best people. When we begin to become more dysfunctional and toxic and bring out the worst, if we know there's certain people that bring out the worst in us, right? I mean, or certain relationships. Well, then there should be certain things that bring out the best, right? This is the study of that, to restore that, to bring your best. And I've always said that in working with special education, that my job was always to find out what your gift was. There is something best within you. I mean, I remember working with the toughest kid that they said, Judy, you'll never be able to assess this kid as a school psychologist. You just won't, because she lay on the ground. She was about 12 years old, and I put her on the ground, but we had her in her chair too, and we supported her in different ways. But we wanted to find something that was strong, okay, so that we could work with it. And they said, I don't think she can hear, I don't think she can see, you're not going to find anything. So I'd bring things in to smell and to touch and do all the rest. And then one day I just put a piece of paper over her nose. It was the third day I was trying to work with her, and just like this went up and knocked that paper off, because it's a sensitive area. And I thought, okay, that's just random, right? So I did it three times, and three times she did it, and then I went flying out and got the physical therapist and the occupational therapist and speech therapist and brought them in and said, look at this, and sure enough, she did it for them. And then I got the call to EMU to go teach here, so I left. So when I came back to do a sabbatical, like 3 years later, and went to that, and they said, come, you got to show you. They had her hooked up to buzzers, electric buzzers. So if she wanted a fan on, she'd hit this one, because this was her good hand now, right? She'd hit this one. If she wanted music, she could hit this one. If she was hungry, she could do. She had some control of her environment. That's bringing her best to the table. You know, and I learned that philosophy way back in working with people that said, you can't touch them. There's nothing there.
And I think sometimes, I mean, I think all the time, the answer is it depends. In Pittsburgh, where I worked, I had students who were throwing chairs, doing any number of things. I remember an instance where a student was in the corner of the room. I put him in a certain corner of the room, and then I had incredible behavior problems. He picked up the table, he's throwing it, he's cussing me out, he's threatening my life. Something's going on here. It's not his best self, obviously. Is it the math? Is it the seating? What is it? Well, come to find out that it was the seating. Come to find out the gap was in safety. And you see, the safest place in the room was the back left corner, because he could see out the windows. And unfortunately, where I taught, I'm sorry, there were guns on the street and school was shot at during the day and all kinds of other things. He could see all of his peers and he could see me. And so the gap isn't always what it presents, and this is why these three M's that we're talking about has to be going at. Is it the gap in the learning, or is it the gap in other needs? And his need for security and control was so great. So restoring to what? Often on an initial level, we want to get rid of conflict. I'm not sure that's always the restoring piece. There's other restorative things. And so our judgment in this space, and it really is judgment, and how do you teach people to do it? I've watched my aunt do it for her entire life. I watch it happen in a crowd, and she does it. She does it in her teaching. And how do you put that in the book? And that's what we're trying to do. So restoring is actually to living the life that God created me to live, which is to live in relationship, in love with myself and him and others. And that includes ideas as well. I think we include that in living in academics. So restoring, we just brought it down to what we think is the core truth, and then it's easy to work upward from that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But thinking about this idea of using conflict, that we are maybe in a moment of truth and vulnerability,
yeah.
That our students, that we are not in normally, I'd like to, more of your guys' experience, these are dramatic, but when you get people in that kind of state, what is some really useful tools for diffusing, moving, building?
And you're talking about student-to-student conflict that comes in, or what are you
talking about? I was thinking of as student-to-student or student-teacher. Are you talking about in your class, in the difficult process with the conflict that was there? But viewing it as a learning opportunity.
Yeah.
So the question is, what are some of the strategies for reducing that conflict when it starts?
Okay.
Or yeah. Using the conflict as opportunity.
Okay. Now, thank you. That's a good question. One of the things that we looked at in developing a language, and this actually came out of some things that, Josh, are you here, that we worked together on, a theory of shared joy. And we come up with this, some of these ideas of looking at, out of the post-traumatic growth, looking at post-conflict growth, and sort of taking it on a sort of a milder level. And when you know that's a possibility, okay, so I'm backing up, not when it happens. Let's go before. Let's go with the sort of how we enter into conflict. What's the mindset that you come? And there are, we've identified at least five of those. You know, they're theoretical in terms of what we're thinking now, but it's really based on post-traumatic growth and our observations. And so if you know that's possible, if you know there may be through that a closer friendship to somebody, if you work on that, it may be closer. You find a path that you may have not seen before. You may see an opportunity. So if you begin to look at it from that perspective, then it's less dangerous, because most of the time we look at it as, oh, this is going to hurt us, and we'll never be able to forgive each other, and so let's just avoid it in terms of doing that. So one of the ways we also do is, and I added that too, because they teach teacher mediation and peer mediation too, which is a part of that process. It always begins with starting to hear their story. What's it like for you? And what's it like for you? But at the end, the two things that we added that I think were really important to that, three things actually, to what the usual processes are out there. And one of it is somewhere you say, what did you learn from this? From the conflict after it's over, okay? So they always know they're going to be asked, what did you learn from this? And so it becomes like, oh, I'm supposed to learn something from this? It's just how you phrase it. It's a language of that. So I'm going to be always asking you, what did you learn from it? And you don't have to say learn. What do you take away from that? And then at the end of it, if they're talking and then they sort of worked out some things, you say something like, how would you like to end this? Oh, when you ask kids that. It's just, and again, we're talking about children more than we're talking about the adult level, because that's my experience with it. Then it's like they come up with creative ideas that now focus on their friendship, right? The relationship living on it. The other thing is in the middle, and Ron Krabel's dissertation was all on this, and I really appreciated that. The first thing that goes out the window in a conflict is your identity. Okay, you don't know who you are. You know, you question who you are. So somewhere within there, if you're a part of that, in that conflict, you give them back their identity. You know, I work with bullying, to teach a bullying class, and we look at, you know, everybody has a story. The people who see it, the persons who've been harmed by that, all of the rest of that, they have that perspective. But to be able to empower them, they need to tell their stories, they need to hear that, and they need to know that they could grow through part of that. And they need to say, you need to affirm them somewhere in there. So somewhere, and say, don't say where it happens in that process, but you're going to say, I noticed it took a lot of courage for you to do that you was vulnerable in that. You're a courageous person. And that's shown through this action. So we make sure we speak of the action and then name that part. So that seems to be skirting around, but that sets the stage for what you do. And then there's a series of that, and it is always, you know, I learned that so quickly. We were working with a kid with scophobia one time. I mean, he wouldn't get on the bus, and we couldn't figure, you know, all this out, so we were trying to do the psychological assessments. I was doing all the rest, and we went to everybody, and finally I just said, why don't you want to get on the bus? You know, I went through all that process, and then he said, who's on the bus that's upsetting him? So we took care of that, and there wasn't any problem. So it's always, you're going to ask, what happened? You know, and teachers don't want to hear that because it's a long story sometimes, and they're not very good. But you have to hear it, and they have to then name it, and you have to name the goodness that's within them that you saw at that time. And then it has to be, so what are we taking away from this, that it has that positive growth-oriented? And then how would we like to end our time together here? And then you can also ask those post-conflict growth things like, so now how are we better because of this? Who do we feel closer to? Or is there something you see now that you didn't see before? All of those things which really come out of that. Now that all has to be tested, right? Right. We need to do that. We need to write the book, and somebody goes out and tests that to see. But you know what? It's really hard to do that, because if you look at the restorative justice, the research that's been done, well, are you doing circles? You know, what are you doing? And, you know, so it's very difficult to assess something that's a depends model. That we don't teach you this step and this step. This is the first thing you do, second thing that you do, and third. So I don't know if I helped you, but the questions. If anything that you learn from a restorative justice approach when you read it is the magic is in the way you ask the questions. And then listen to the answer.
And this statement just seemed to work for me. The student who was going off, I simply said, what do I need to know? And I sat down. What do I need to know? And the message that kid needed to know then from me, and I learned this the hard way, I just simply started saying, you know what, I'm in it. I'm in this, I'm not going anywhere. Tried this one on one of my children as well, to say, you know, when it gets really hot, I'm not going anywhere. What do I need to know? And so that's kind of that question.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's not the question that's so important, but it's stopping and listening to the answer.
Yeah. Yeah. And also being able to read that. You know, it's sort of, I can say, what's happening with you right now? I mean, Lori has a story of stopping in the middle. I mean, that's one of those ideas of the it's just being able to read them well enough to say.
Yeah, I stopped in the middle of class, if any of my needs of diverse learner students happen to be in here, and just said, okay, it's not working. What do I need to know? And so I quickly just slapped up a midterm evaluation. Boy, did I need to know a lot. And I named one of those things today, and I said, you noticed I got rid of this strategy, and they all just looked sheepish. And I said, it's okay, there were more than six of you who said the same thing. And so literally in the middle, instead of getting offended and trying to say they're not reading, they're not doing all of this, I stopped and said, I gotta believe that they wanna learn. What do I need to know? And did that last week and 2 weeks ago, and shifted all kinds of things in my teaching that wasn't major. They were minor things, but they made the difference. We're on a new page.
This is not a question, or I guess it's mostly just a comment. I have probably the most unique opportunity of anybody here at EMU, in that my office is right across the hall from Judy's. And most of the time when she's in her office, she doesn't keep her door shut, and I don't keep mine shut. And so I'm often listening to what's happening in her office.
And thank you, Galen. I didn't know that.
And all of this rings very true with what I've seen in this presentation, because I can't tell you how many times I have heard Judy in her office listening to a student, sharing from the depths of their soul and so on. And then Judy gets this really sort of, in her own way, this little excited, almost squeal kind of voice and says, I just love what you were thinking, or I just love what you've done. And that one comment of Judy responding in that kind of way, affirming students and so on, it's just so interesting. The interesting thing is, our office doors don't line up, so I can never watch what's going on, but I always hear what follows that then, and how students feel so affirmed and so built up, and how those relationships of Judy restoring whatever it is to that student is just a wonderful thing. Thank you, Judy.
Thank you. Oh, well, thank you. I'm honored. And I want to say one more thing about what Josh and I, we worked on. We worked on a languages of gratitude because for children and also, you know, some for adults. We picked up on some other ideas. And I have learned so much from students and from just examining and learning a new language and from Kim and you all, too. Thank you.
One final point on that. We're sometimes accused of standing at the front of the class and looking similar. And we are also convinced that you don't need to look or act like either one of us, and that these three pieces actually work coming from you in whoever you are. And so the voice, the language, et cetera, but the idea of that affirmation, she is seeing on that first M there. She's really trying to figure out, okay, what is my mindset that I have? And she sets it very carefully. But it's going to look different for everybody in this room. It's going to sound different, not just in voice tone, but in word choice. And we don't think that makes a difference. It's more that those three M's are there.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe our time has ended.
Thank you, Lori and Judy, for inspiring us all to be our best selves.